I'm Michelle Ernsting. In the mid-14th century, the bacterium causing the deadly bubonic plague arrived in the West via trade routes from the East. No one had ever seen anything like it, but in a matter of years, millions had died. In the Black Death, I'll be tracing the history of the bubonic plague and its impact on Europe today.
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents The Black Death, produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
The ancient Silk Route brought riches from east to west, rare treasures never seen before, and among them, a deadly cargo, too small to be seen, a microbe which caused two plagues, one which racked the body, and another which opened the darkest corners of our minds. The bacterium Yersinia pestis, so tiny, yet its path is marked by the wide swath of the Black Death. It came swiftly across windswept Mongolia. In the 1340s, a Khan of the Golden Horde lays siege to the Black Sea port of Kaffa by catapulting bodies of plague victims over the city walls. Genovese traders fled, carrying the bacteria along the trade tendrils, reaching into the Mediterranean and Northern Europe.
It was coming, or something was coming, but it was absolutely unknown what was coming. And of course, the way people reacted to it was with absolute shock and horror.
Ships filled with the dead and infected drift into harbors from Marseille to Bergen.
It must have been a feeling like being in a large meat grinder or something like that. Something that has no brain and just kills and comes closer and closer and stabs you in the back or in the front or coming from upstairs or from under your feet, not knowing where it comes from, but it's deadly.
Carts piled high with the dead rumble through the stinking streets of Prague, Paris, London.
The first thing that the chroniclers and the medical profession reflects on, they knew their history and they describe the plague of Thucydides and the plague of St. Gregory, but then they stop and they say, this plague is categorically different from anything Europe or the world has ever experienced.
The first sign of the plague was the rats crawling out of all corners to die. Streets were cluttered with tiny corpses poisoned by the bite of a common flea. The flea itself carried the deadly microbe.
Well, there's a good evidence that this disease did travel at a speed that is not known in the modern plague at all, even with the assistance of steamship and the railroad and the motor car. Modern plague depends on rats, and rats, for the most part, that stays around the home. In New Orleans in 1915, there were studies of rat migration, and they were astounded to find that some rats traveled as far as 4 miles. This is over the course of a year or more. On the other hand, in the Middle Ages, this disease was traveling as much as 6 miles, not a year, but 6 miles a day.
The Black Death is possibly the most virulent epidemic in history. The bacteria had an insatiable hunger and leapt from host to host, consuming them within days. No one had ever seen anything like it.
It began both in men and women with certain swellings in the groin or under the armpit. They grew to the size of a small apple or an egg. Soon after this, the symptoms changed and black or purple spots appeared on the arms or thighs or any other part of the body. These spots were a certain sign of death.
A description by writer Giovanni Boccaccio in the opening pages of his 14th century classic, The Decameron, about a group of wealthy young people from Florence who flee to a suburban villa to escape death by plague. 2 out of every 3 people in Florence died of the pestilence.
Most people who are infected with plague are infected by insect bite. It would be the bite of a flea. In the process of biting, some of the plague bacteria would be injected subcutaneously into the person, and then the bacteria would spread very rapidly from the site of injection into the local lymphatic system and then cause inflammation of those local lymphatics, causing a large lump or bubo.
Infected lumps, fever, excruciating pain. The body was tormented by the bacteria. Yet it seems there was a second plague, one which infected the mind.
Cities must have been lunatic asylums. Almost everybody was a mental patient at that time. The fear for death striking all around, bodies lying everywhere. It must have been an ordeal. What it did to the human brain, knowing that we are sitting here and you carrying or me carrying a deadly disease, would mean that we would both lay on the same cart in 1.5 hours.
I'm here in the Rijksmuseum, the Royal Museum in Amsterdam, and I'm looking at a statue which really reflects the madness of the 1600s when waves of plague epidemics passed through this area. Now, this particular statue stood in front of the madhouse in Amsterdam, and often these houses were called dol- en pesthuizen, or plague and madhouses. And that's because often plague victims were placed in asylums. That was the only place where people could house them. Now, this particular statue is of a woman, and she's naked, she's falling forward on one knee, and her body is twisted around, and she's got her hands, her arms up in the air, and she's pulling her hair out, huge handfuls of long hair. She's looking skyward, and her mouth is open. You can tell she's screaming, she's crying out. And the whole statue, it's life-size, and it's just an overwhelming vision of agony. And all around the base of this statue, there are windows carved in the side. And in the windows, you see the faces of people who are also obviously mad. And this is to represent the fact that tourists, people visiting in Amsterdam, could come to the madhouse. And for a fee, they would be able to stare at these people who are insane through openings in their locked cell doors. It's a horrible idea, but at the time, that was considered a good way to spend an afternoon, I suppose. Now, at this time, madness and plague were really a part of life, and often they went hand in hand. And they were even called gifts of the god, a rather vengeful god, I would say. But what this meant was that people thought the only way to escape this fate was to live a very pious and a very austere kind of life. And here in the Netherlands, this significantly affected how people acted in their daily lives.
You saw, in reaction to the plague, a kind of higher religious life. I mean, people were, of course, praying like crazy not to get the plague. And they also were, in a fanatic way, religious. They moved from city to city, praying, singing, punishing themselves. And there were, on the other hand, excessive eating parties, for instance. I mean, people, in a way, had an idea that the chance that they would live through this was small, so why keep yourself in hand anymore? That was quite a different reaction, but it was also there.
Everything imaginable and unimaginable happens in such a situation. It shows you, I think, all the corners of the human mind.
There were, of course, these outbursts of hate and rage against certain groups, especially the Jews. Especially in the German countries, this was very often the case. And, well, perhaps people wanted to try to keep things in control. I mean, to have the idea that somebody or something was the cause of all this suffering.
Tens of thousands of Jews were burned or slaughtered. Many more were forced to migrate to what is now Russia and Poland. There had been other illnesses, and there would be many more, but the Black Death seemed to compel many to act out their darkest thoughts.
We are still with that problem. The fear of the foreign, the fear of the unknown, who's that man, where is he coming from? People had to give in their names and where they came from, to see whether they came from infected areas. It tried to shut out the thing that came from the outside.
But while people struck out against strangers to protect themselves and their loved ones, these same lovers, sisters, fathers, and mothers soon became strangers.
This is a death that was spread by person to person, and more particularly by, in fact, corpse. So there was this sense of abandonment, as one chronicler after another and one storyteller after another tells us, that sons abandon fathers abandon sons, husbands abandon wives, etc. And you even have this nice story by Franco Sacchetti, which talks about this man who leaves a last will and testament in times of plague, and he leaves a major portion of his estate to the flies, that every year on the anniversary of his death, that pears are to be cut up and left on his grave so that flies can enjoy them, because it was only flies who were the ones not to abandon him during his hour of his sickness. There's a sense of people wanting to be remembered, and they leave paintings, even peasants leave commissions for paintings above their graves, whereby they are to be depicted in their very likeness, and this is what the demand is and the will, and to be placed above the grave so that their bodily remains are remembered. The obsession with one's own mortality and one's family name become stamped on European history following the Black Death.
So our graveyards wouldn't look the way they do now had it not been for the Black Death.
Well, I think we can say that the whole importance of tombstones and monuments to celebrate bodily remains and to recognize the individuals is, in a quantitative sense, the effect of the Black Death, yes.
A desire to be remembered. As many as 24 million people perished in Europe in a few years. Those left behind did not have much time to reflect on the dead. They had to make sense of a strange new landscape. Whole professions had died out. Doctors, lawyers, monks, and priests. Every living body was now needed. Peasants who had never been paid before for their work could now set their own price. It was a world turned upside down.
Well, here one can take in a rather simplistic economic model, especially if you're dealing with someone like a peasant. With decline of population, his labor value goes up and his wages goes up. And hence you see this not only in England but in other places of Europe that haven't been studied yet. New labor legislation to put a ceiling on wages so that peasants couldn't play the market, so that they couldn't migrate to farms where wages were higher, so that they had to accept wages which were lower.
This is one of many changes. At the time of the outbreak, there were only a few centers of learning in Europe. A fear of travel during and after the plague prompted the creation of new universities, such as the University in Prague. Classes were taught in local languages, ending the dominance of Latin. It's extraordinary to think a microbe shifted our development and continues to shift it in profound ways.
Before the Black Death, basically the whole history of population was determined by war, disease, and famine. Afterwards, the systems of population change with a much more of a sense of controlling populations, primarily through levels of nuptiality, of ages at marriage and the percentage of people marrying. So that one big change after the Black Death, when it actually settles in, is still up for discussion, but is a distinctive European marriage pattern that separates Western Europe from any other part of the globe and separates the history of European demography up until about 1920. 1920 as different from any other time in world history. And this is basically a pattern where you have high ages of marriage for both men and women and a substantial number of people remaining celibate.
After the Black Death epidemic of 1348, the plague ebbed. In the 1600s, it returned again in waves, never with the same intensity, but this time it had become part of the cycle of life in the Middle Ages.
Nowadays, wars are an item in news. In the 18th century, in the 19th century, in the 17th century, diseases were the big issue. Where is the plague? What kind of disease are there in Krakow, where those ships are coming from wood in the harbor of Amsterdam? It was predictable that when the wind turned and the moats were stinking, there was an epidemic coming. And for instance, in a city of Amsterdam, which was bigger, it was a huge town in the 17th century, 18th century, the richer went to places outside to wait until the epidemics and the foul air was gone again.
And what about people who didn't have the money or didn't have the luxury of being able to leave the city?
They simply died and they accepted that.
People might have accepted it, but here in the Netherlands, town councillors didn't. In the town of Leiden, they watched in horror as their tax base diminished with each death. A town without people was a town without power. So they set up the Plague and Madness House, and they also arranged for people to collect the corpses in wooden carts and dispose of them.
When you look at old pictures, and certainly those pictures drawn in the 19th century, about the 14th century, you just see carts driving through almost empty cities with doctors who have very eerie masks on their face and then walking like birds of death through the city. They were dressed in black with very large robes hanging on the ground, giving air no opportunity to reach the body. They also wore a mask, a kind of beak in front, in which there was a sponge drenched in disinfecting fluids, vinegar, for instance. And they wore a big hat on top of their heads. And on that hat, there was a flap on the back. So they were covered in clothes and wearing a mask. Somehow, they had the idea that the spreading of the disease might be caused by something like bad air. It's the starting of a new era of understanding diseases.
In the late 14th and 15th century, more human explanations take on currency for understanding plague, particularly in the 15th century with increasing legislation against the spread of plague by people and by goods as opposed to being spread by God and other supernatural phenomena. So there becomes much more of an emphasis on contagion theories that are working not only within the medical profession, but also by the legislation of city government.
They started to reorganize, for instance, water supply in the city. They reorganized hygienical methods. They reorganized the battle against rats and other animals in the city.
All these measures, but never a clear sense of what it was that brought on the plague.
The finding of microorganisms was something in the 19th century that came out of the blue, which is actually, to my opinion, not true. There has always been a thought, an evaluation, a deduction of, well, the origin of the disease must be there, not hooking it on a microorganism that swims and goes through tissue or something. But there must be something very small. It must be around us. So we have to prevent us from being infected by this thing.
By this time in the 1600s, there were many other epidemics raging. In this century, illnesses such as tuberculosis, malaria, and even influenza have surpassed the bubonic plague in terms of mortality. Yet it seems to rest more deeply in our collective memory.
Certainly in the scholarly and scientific worlds, I think the Black Death laid a heavy burden, as well as a heavy remembrance on the emphasis on plague. And hence, it's the reason why when plague broke out in Hong Kong in 1894 and then later in Bombay in 1896, there was so much attention given to this plague. It was because they thought it was the Black Death and that it could invade Europe once again in the way it had done in 1348. So if anything, given the relative weights of this mortality and what this disease did in comparison to cholera, typhus, and malaria, these diseases killed far more people during the worst period of plague, even in Bombay, than bubonic plague did. And yet we get the most extraordinary research on the plague in India by bacteriologists, by geographers, this massive research such that we have this quantitative data that doesn't exist for any other disease at any other time. And my sense is that it had to do with the legacy of this Black Death in Europe. It also had a legacy, I believe, in retarding the understanding of how this epidemic worked. So the knowledge of history, or rather the imperfect knowledge of history, can be a bad thing.
Dr. Davis, telephone, please. Dr. Davis, telephone, please.
At St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, microbiologist Michael Prentice is trying to tease the facts from the tales handed down through history. He's using the latest technology to do so. More than 300 years ago, his former colleagues at the hospital were struggling to cope with an onslaught of plague victims. The plague pits surrounding the hospital's foundations attest to this. Medieval doctors knew little about why the plague tide ebbed or flowed, but how much more do we know today?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't think anybody could say why plague did arrive and go away, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to study it.
Dr. Prentice is mapping the DNA of Yersinia pestis as part of the Human Genome Mapping Project. It's being carried out by the Sanger Center, funded by the Wellcome Trust. Each finding is put in the public domain so that all researchers can access this information. Up until now, military institutes have collected the bulk of what we know about this deadly microbe. But even with new maps, so little is known about how this bacterium functions.
There aren't any very compelling reasons why urban plague did go away in Europe. Various explanations from changing rat population or improving hygiene have been advanced. Whatever the factors are, they're certainly by no means accepted by everybody. From the point of view of security, it would be as good to know as much as we can about Yersinia pestis in case it did make a resurgence.
My views are that networks of communication and changes in these networks of communication are absolutely vital for the spread of any disease, so that society perhaps was changing over the 14th, 13th, 14th century with the commercial revolution, with the interconnection and interdependency of cities, so that disease would, whatever the disease was, would spread in a way that it perhaps couldn't have spread, say, in the 12th century. And in fact, today, you find the same debate going on with the spread of AIDS and other diseases out of Africa, that mass airline transportation has completely changed our networks of communication of diseases. I think one generalization is that there's no place in the world that's more than 3 days away from New York City. And that this has been an explosion, really, of the 1980s, even though the technology of air travel hasn't changed dramatically, the mass numbers of air travelers has.
Various things have happened in the last few years that make it relevant to study plague nowadays. In 1994, there was a relatively small outbreak in India, which, certainly before the Second World War, had millions of cases of plague, and there was mass panic. Everybody felt that this organism had come back. That brought it to the attention of the world, the fact that a country squarely on most of the international trade routes could be affected with plague. Subsequent to that, there's been a worrying development in Madagascar, where there was a report in the New England Journal of Medicine of a multi-resistant strain of Yersinia pestis, which seemed to be resistant to most of the commonly used antibiotics. Until then, all strains of plague isolated in the wild had been regarded as sensitive to antibiotics, but the fact that you could get a resistant organism certainly set a lot of people worrying of implications for the future if you ever did get wide circulation of a resistant strain of Yersinia pestis.
Each day we learn more and more about this bacterium, but perhaps we should also be looking more closely at ourselves. It was not the bacteria which made enemies of friends, kindled fanatical sects, and ignited racial hatred that was stirred up in the human mind. What have we really learned about this aspect of the plague, about ourselves?
What it teaches perhaps is more a question. I mean, in what way we should react if something like this happens to us. And it begs the question, what should we do? How will our social ties, will they also break down if something like this happens to us? And I cannot say that I'm curious, because I would not want to live to see it. But for instance, in India, there was this outbreak of the plague, and then you saw immediately, kind of comparable reactions. Doctors who fled, people who refused to take care of their families. And this was only, a minor outbreak. But even then you saw this comparable reactions. And then, that raised the question, what will happen if a real new epidemic will arrive in this world? And I think it will not bring the best of us to the front.
In terms of psychology and understanding the plague, as far as lessons, I don't know, but it is interesting that different diseases have different psychological impact, whereas tuberculosis was even romanticized in the 19th century, as one can see and hear in opera. The Black Death and AIDS in particular, I think, at least in their immediate impact, have had much more terrifying effects on population. And the effects have led to much more racial, homophobic types of violence, or rather pinpointing certain populations as scapegoats than other diseases. It is interesting to sort of understand the collective psychology that different diseases have and why this should be the case.
Why do you think this is the case?
One could be the fact that other diseases seem to be less mysterious, how they work, at least when they're initially exposed. For instance, even as terrifying as cholera was, the mechanisms of this disease in the 19th century were not quite as mysterious as that of the Black Death, which seemed altogether new in history. Similarly, I think AIDS had this terrifying aspect.
It's a frightening thought to think that when we can't find the answer to why a disease is attacking us, we accuse each other.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And why that's the case is, I think, an interesting topic or book for someone to write. I don't have the answer.
Medieval historian Samuel Kahn ponders these ideas, as has French writer Albert Camus in his book The Plague. He imagined an epidemic would bring out people's worst fears, but also, in many, a courageous resistance to give in to this fear. While the plague is fought in hospitals, the real battle is waged in people's minds. When the plague finally runs its course in his book, the terrible occupation ends, fear gives way to pure joy, but Camus ends his tale with a warning. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know but could have learned from books. That the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good. That it can lie dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chests. That it bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves. And that perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and the enlightening of men, it roused up its rats again and sent them forth to die in a happy city.
The Black Death was produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.